Turn again to Isaiah chapter 40 and from verse 12. When God's people are in deep distress and say, "The Lord has cast us off and abandoned us," what ought you to tell them to do? To tell them to cheer themselves up by going shopping, join a gardening club or whatever? No, according to Isaiah, they need to be faced up to certain and many questions. And we've got 18 questions here in this passage this morning. And the aim is to get God's people to think, to meditate. They need to be made to think about what kind of God we have, and they need to see that their God is a God in a class all by himself. He's utterly unique. That's the thrust of this passage, the second part of Isaiah 40. It's a prescription for despair. You can see the need for it in the despair of the Lord's people. The question that's being answered is the question that's raised in verse 27, where Isaiah says, "Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my just claim is passed over by my God?" That's the charge they're bringing against God, the despair of the Lord's people. And everything that Isaiah says here in this second part of the chapter is targeted at that need, the fact that God has not responded to the people in the way they expected. So what do you tell the Lord's people when they're in despair like that? Well, you give them a prescription, and this prescription comes in two parts. The first is to let your mind dwell upon the facts about God. Let your mind dwell upon the facts about God, from verse 12 to 26. And Isaiah says, first of all, that you are to let your mind dwell upon the fact of God's wisdom. Verses 13 and 14, and then the end of verse 28. Verse 13 and 14, "Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord? Or has his counselors taught him? With whom did he take counsel? And who instructed him and taught him in the path of justice? Who taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding?" And Isaiah obviously expects a negative answer. He expects the answer to be no one. And the questions themselves are almost playful, aren't they? If we were to cast them into a modern turn of phrase, we might ask, who is God's policy advisor? Who is the Lord's defense secretary? What firm of consultants advise him on the environment or whatever? Who helps brief God on the great issues of the day? Who boosts his performance? Who enables God to act more efficiently? The answer is no one. J.B. Phillips, a Bible translator, was doing some youth work in London in a parish at the end of the Second World War, and he asked the teens in the meeting, "Does God understand radar?" And their immediate response was, "No." They didn't think God was up to date. Of course, God didn't understand radar. That's modern, they thought. And no doubt today there are many who think that God is mystified by DNA and the inner workings of a personal computer and so on, just because we are. God, many think, belongs to and belongs in the past. But Isaiah is reminding us here that the living God is fully omnicompetent. And the answer expected to all these questions is the negative. God doesn't need any help. And in verse 13 and 14, he tells us that God runs this world and he makes his plans according to wisdom. And he has all the knowledge, all the discernment, all the wisdom, all the competence to do things right. And of course, there's an implication that flows from that. And it's this, that no circumstance in life should alarm you. If God knows what he's doing, if he does run this world wisely in wisdom, no circumstance should alarm you as God's people. It's not that no circumstance will perplex you, because they will. It's not that no circumstance should disturb you, because they do. But no circumstance should alarm you. You should never come to the conclusion that God doesn't know what he's doing. No circumstance should alarm you, because no circumstance in your life and every life is outside of God's control. He orders everything, and he does all things according to his wisdom. But what about the conundrums of life? What about the circumstances and the events that take place that perplex us? Well, verse 28 helps us there when it says, there is no searching out his understanding. Sometimes we come across events and circumstances that baffle us. But the fact is that though these things baffle us, that doesn't mean that they're senseless. And though we run into situations that baffle us and we wonder, why is God doing things this way? The fact that we don't get it doesn't mean that it's not understandable. His understanding is unsearchable. I can't explore, I can't exhaust or explain God's understanding. But the fact that his ways perplex me does not mean that his ways are not wise. His ways are wise. He is competent. And sometimes I've just got to leave things there at that point. Just because I might not be able to comprehend just how God's wisdom directs all the affairs of men at any given point. Just because it's incomprehensible to me and my finite mind does not mean it's absurd. There is no searching of his understanding. God is wise, and yet oftentimes he is mysteriously so. And we need to let our minds dwell then on God's wisdom. And if God is wise and competent to reign, then no circumstance in life should alarm you. And then Isaiah says, let your mind dwell on God's immensity. Verse 12 and verses 15 to 22. Let your mind dwell on God's immensity. Now, when I say that, I'm just picking up on the way in which Isaiah is speaking to us here. When I speak of God's immensity, what I'm referring to is the fact that God is above all creation. And the fact that he isn't confined to time and space. But notice how Isaiah says that. For instance, in verse 12, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, measured heaven with a span, and calculated the dust of the earth in a measure? A span is the distance between the small finger, the tip of the small finger, and the tip of the tongue, the thumb. Imagine measuring light years with a span. And then he says, who has calculated the dust of the earth in a measure and weighed the mountains in the scales and the hills in a balance? Imagine taking all the mountains and hills of the earth and weighing them in a great scales. Who could do such a thing? Only someone who is immense, who is gigantic. Only someone massive. And so by such questions, what Isaiah is doing is trying to convey an impression of size and sheer grandeur, the sheer immensity and greatness of God. He is asking questions to help you see how massive God is. You see the same thing in verse 16. Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor its beasts sufficient for a burnt offering. Now, Lebanon was famed for its huge cedar trees. Well, what if we ignored all the conservationists and we took the cedars of Lebanon and chopped them all down to make firewood for a sacrifice? And when you've chopped them all down, you take all the livestock of Lebanon and you put them on that fire for a burnt offering. It's not big enough, says Isaiah. It's not adequate. There is no way that all of that could equate to the grandeur of the living God. So Isaiah is trying to appeal to you via your imagination. He's not just addressing the mind. It's not just an intellectual exercise. But he's trying to stir up your imagination. And often that approach is necessary, isn't it? If you had to, for example, produce a leaflet for tourists to a major attraction, well, you wouldn't print out a single sheet of A4 in black ink on white paper, would you? You would want the paper folded perhaps into three with full-colour photographs through it. You wouldn't print a list of facts like Big Pit is close to Blenavon and it's free to explore because it's funded by the Welsh Assembly Government. No, you'd say, experience the excitement of descending more than 300 feet into the darkness of a coal mine, an authentic coal mine, and being led around the coal mine workings by men who used to work there tearing the coal from the ground and so on. You'd tell about the new multimedia tour and all the ancillary exhibitions and the gift shop and everything else that goes with it. So you don't just give raw data and facts, but you want to stir the imagination, give a sense of what it's like. And that's what Isaiah is doing for us here. But why is it necessary for us to think great thoughts about God, as Isaiah is trying to get us to do here? Well, it's because the world distorts and limits God. And Isaiah refers to that in verse 19 and 20. The workman molds an image. The goldsmith overspreads it with gold. The silversmith casts silver chains. Whoever is to impoverish for such a contribution chooses a tree that will not rot. He seeks for himself a skillful workman to prepare a carved image that will not totter. What he's doing there is mocking paganism. But this is why we have to think about God and have great thoughts of God's majesty. It's because pagans are always trying to confine and limit and thereby distort God's character and nature. And Isaiah is depicting here an image, an idol being made, and it's expensive and it's artistic and it's durable and it's immobile, and that's supposed to represent God. But it limits God. The image makes God manageable for the worshippers, brings God down to the place where I can control him. Always, inevitably, images of God distort the truth about God. And that's because you can't take the whole truth about God and pack it into a representing image. Inevitably, you have to eliminate certain truths about God, and you'll distort the truth about God as you're attempting to convey him by an image. An image limits God, distorts God. It makes him a prisoner of man. And it's necessary to remind ourselves of that, even though we don't use images in our worship here. Some Christians can be impatient. I know when you mention this, it's just not relevant to us, they think. So why waste time talking about using images in the worship of God? But really we should, because sometimes it's not just what does the Bible say to me now that matters. But sometimes we have to get back to Bible times and think about what it was like then. And what was it like then? It was like this. Just try telling an ancient pagan that you can't worship God with an image. Everybody knew that you had to worship God that way. Almost everybody in the ancient Near East worshipped, and they all worshipped using images. Except Israel. The whole world worships by means of images, and you are the only people that don't? Don't you think you ought to have some doubts about that? Everybody else uses images, and we don't? How could we be right? It would be like everybody around you, except you and your family, eats apples. Every child at school, except yours, takes an apple to school. Your workmates on the building site, or wherever it is you work, they've got apples in their lunchbox. You go to a theatre in the evening, and during the performance there's an apple break. And everyone chomps on an apple, but not you. You don't. Everybody but you and your family. And inevitably, you will think, well, what's wrong with us? Why don't we do this? There would be so much pressure to go along with everybody else. And all around Israel, everybody except Israel used images. To use the modern lingo, that's how they did worship. That's how they did church back then. You approach God by using an image, an idol. But when you get to verse 21 and 22, you find Isaiah telling us that you can't contain the uncontainable God. at how he puts it there in verse 22. It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to dwell in. He is immense. You can't limit him by bringing him down to an image, but everybody else worshipped him that way. So where did you get this idea that God isn't to be worshipped by using an image? Well, perhaps it's because God revealed that to his people. So if you grasp something of the immensity of God, you'll never try to control him, you'll never try to manipulate him, you'll never use an image, you'll never try to bring him down to manageable proportions in some way. If you really grasp anything of how immense and how majestic the living God is, no idol will ever seduce you. If you've been taken by the reality of God, you're not going to be taken in. You're not going to be conned by an image or an idol. If you have any sense at all of how majestic God is, there'll be no flimsy substitutes, no matter how popular they may be, that will capture your affections, except the living God. So think on God's immensity. And then, says Isaiah, think about God's rule over the nations. Let your mind dwell upon God's rule over nations and empires. Now, you might think that God isn't interested in politics, but he is. Isaiah says that God is mired in politics. God is over politics. He controls it. And you might think, but why would Israel in their despair want to hear that? And the answer is that they needed to hear this because the mighty nations, verses 15 and 17, the domineering rulers, verses 23 and 24, are going to rule over them, Israel, following this prophecy of Isaiah. You remember we looked at that last week in chapter 39. And so they needed to know how they were to think about these powers and these rulers. When superpowers and tyrants are ruling over them, what should they think about that? Well, they needed to know how the living God, their God, regards the nations, how he deals with the rulers and so on. And how does God regard the nations? Verse 17, all the nations before him are as nothing. They are counted by him as less than nothing and worthless. Imagine having that printed above the main entrance of the UN building. But you might think, doesn't that undermine the significance of nations? And the answer is no. See, what Isaiah is doing is putting down the arrogance of the nations. He's putting the nations in their place, in their proper place. And we see in verse 23 and 24 that as God's people think about what they may meet later, they are given a certain philosophy of history. He brings the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth useless. Scarcely shall they be planted, scarcely shall they be sown, scarcely shall their stock take root in the earth, when he will blow on them, and they will wither, and the whirlwind will take them away like stubble. The Lord's people, in every generation, need to remember that. Remember how Daniel, in chapter 2, the prophet there, interprets the dream of King Nebuchadnezzar. He'd seen this great image with a head of gold and so on, and it was a revelation to him of the history of the world that was to follow the Babylonian Empire, the various empires that would rise and fall. And as Daniel interprets the vision, he says to Nebuchadnezzar very courageously, after you, another king will arise. Very courageous. There's always an after you. It's as if he was saying, Nebuchadnezzar, both you and Babylon are heading for the rubbish dump. The living God puts the rulers of the earth in their place. They don't often last very long. He blows on them. And like the chaff in the wind, they're blown away. That is a help and an encouragement to God's people, isn't it? When they're in despair. The people of God in countries like Vietnam face a frightening political power, tyranny, regimes of godless men who seek to trample down the people of God and destroy and annihilate them. In Burma today, there is still a military government whose influence, or indifference, I should say, to the well-being of their people is well known, graphically displayed. Was it in 2008 when they refused any international aid to their country that was devastated by a cyclone? In their warfare against armed resistance among the tribal groupings in Burma, one of the tactics used by the government was to take men and women and children from the Karen people of Burma, a Christian tribal people, and force them to walk in front of the armed army through suspected minefields. And many of them were horribly maimed and killed in that way. That's the sort of thing that the regimes of this world do. And you don't need me to mention to you more spectacular examples of oppression than that. But what does the Lord say about that? He says they may have their day, but scarcely are they planted, scarcely shall they be sown, scarcely shall their stock take root in the earth, when he will blow on them and they will wither, and the whirlwind will take them away like stubble. It's all over for them. And if that's the case, the implication of that is there is no regime that can destroy the people of God. And then he says, let your mind settle on God's intensity. Verse 25 and 26. In other words, there's not only God's immensity, his grandeur, his power, but there's also his intense interest in details. Verse 26. Lift up your eyes on high, and see who has created these things, who brings out their host by number. He calls them all by name. He's a God of intense detail. Lift up your eyes, he says. What do you see? Well, in the ancient Near East, if you lifted up your eyes, you saw more gods, more deities. They worshipped the stars, which represented various gods and goddesses, but not to Israel. To God's people, they were God's creation. Undeified stars. And Isaiah says, look at them, what do you see? You see a vast and innumerable host, and yet God has knowledge of them, because he calls each one of them by a name. They tell us that on a clear night the naked eye can distinguish about 2,000 stars. God gives every one of them a name, each one. But we know, presumably, what Isaiah didn't know, which is that there are trillions of stars in the universe, and all of them God calls by a name. God is a God of intense detail, and vastness does not preclude intimacy. It does on the human level, I know. If there's a vast crowd of people, you can't be intimately involved in the lives of all of them, but with the living God, vastness does not preclude intimacy. You don't get lost in a crowd with God. Psalm 147 verses 3 and 4 says, he heals the brokenhearted and binds up their wounds. He counts the number of the stars and he calls them all by name. Well, what a striking connection that is to make. God doesn't get caught up with the intricacies of a vast universe, but he also remembers the brokenhearted. He keeps an eye on his people, the psalmist is saying. You don't get lost in a vast crowd of humanity. God knows your name. We're told the same in John 10, aren't we, verse 3. He calls his own sheep by name and he leads them. Isaiah says, let your mind dwell upon facts about God. And you will realize, if you do that, that no circumstance should ever alarm you. No idol should ever seduce you. No regime can ever destroy you. No vastness can ever obscure you. Let your mind dwell upon these facts about God. And then the second part of what Isaiah does here is to place our despair next to the sufficiency of God. Place your despair next to the sufficiency of God. Verses 27 through to 31. In verse 28 and 29, we've got a picture of the mighty God who sustains. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the heavens and the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, he increases strength. Now you might say, I already know that. And Isaiah says that. He says, I think you know this already. You know this. You've heard about this, haven't you? And what Isaiah is doing is saying to us, you need to take this doctrine that you say that you know, and you've got to rub it in so that it becomes part of you, so that it grips you. And you've got to realize the implication of these things that you already know about God. You have a God who sustains. And again, you might say that you already know that, but back in Isaiah's time, ancient paganism didn't know that. Pagan deities would become hungry and thirsty, and so they had to get their sacrifices on time and so on. Pagan deities ate and drank and slept and traveled and had sex and relieved themselves, just like men and women do. They were gods made in our image. But Isaiah says here that the living God isn't like that. He doesn't get tired out. He doesn't need inexhaustible supplies of energy to be given to him, donated to him. He doesn't need Lucozade to keep going. He is inexhaustible, and he keeps on giving power to the faint. It all goes in the other direction with the living God. He's the mighty God who sustains. And then he gives another picture in verses 30 and 31. A picture of believing people who endure. Believing people who endure. Who are the ones who endure? Verse 31, they're the ones who wait on the Lord. What does that mean? It means being confident that the Lord will act, and being willing to wait for him to act. So it's got an element of trust and time. You trust the Lord to act, and you wait for the Lord to act in his time. You've got a picture of that again in Isaiah 33, where we read, O Lord, be gracious to us. We have waited for you. Be our arm every morning, our salvation also in the time of trouble. And these who benefit from the Lord's strength, they're not the fittest. They're not those, verse 30, who run a marathon. They're not naturally endowed with strength, but they're waiting on the Lord. That means that no weariness will exhaust you. But how? How will they go on having strength? Verse 29, because he keeps on giving power to the faint. That's why. And therefore no weariness can exhaust them. It's a strange mark of God's people. You know, pastors really aren't much help to people when they're in the midst of trouble. Frankly, apart from occasional words that pastors can give to encourage, there's little more that a pastor can do than to sit and watch. And what pastors observe is a very strange phenomenon. It is that God's people just keep going and going and going. They keep going through loss and through grief, through incredible pressures, through shattering disappointments, through gnawing aggravations, and they just keep going and going. Why? It's because there really is a God who does not faint or grow weary, who really goes on giving power to the faint. That's the explanation for it. That's how it happens. The Lord keeps giving power, keeps sustaining them. The God of the Bible never does faint or grow weary. He really does keep on giving power to the weak. So Isaiah speaks to a despairing people, and he says, let your minds become fixated on these facts about God. Dwell upon them, meditate upon them. And then he says, place your despair next to the sufficiency of this God. That's how you answer this despair.